All right, if you remember, we are starting with the last section in the book of Proverbs. And the reason why we're doing this is honestly just to get a change of pace. So the material as you have it is organized very logically so that like one thing just kind of builds on the other and takes very small steps. But maybe the steps are too small. So what we're going to do with each of these sections is we're going to have a topic and then you have all the verses that are on that theme. All right, and the questions are going to walk through almost all of the verses. So we're going to look at probably most of them, probably about 90% at some point. It's just more than we can do. So we'll have to just move on from there. So what we're going to do is we're going to jump to the last section, which deals with governments and kings and judges and peoples and things like that. So the first thing that I want to talk about, which is a new question that's not in your section, is just motivation. Like, how in the world does this apply to us? There's no kings in here. There's no queens in here. There's no judges. How do we make application of this to ourselves? So I want to spend a little bit of time and think about that question. And this is one of my favorite sections to go through because I think it kind of opens your mind and broadens your mind to looking at a lot of scriptures and not only seeing yourself a little bit differently, but seeing the Bible a little bit differently as well. So just think about this and then we'll get into our normal questions after this. So first of all, I want you to think about that all Christians are considered priests. All right, so if you look at 1 Peter 2, 4 through 10, it says that we're a spiritual house and that we're a spiritual priesthood. It even says we're a royal priesthood. All right, so what is a priest? I'm going to take a step back and think about that for a second. Think about the old law. Think about actually any religion. What does a priest do? Well, he stands kind of as a go-between or a mediator between man and God. He takes man, his sacrifices, he offers sacrifices on his behalf, he pleads on his behalf, he atones on his behalf, God, please forgive them. That's what a priest does. He represents man to God and pleads on his behalf. But he also represents God to man. He reveals what God wants man to do. He teaches man what God wants him to do. So he's a go-between. He stands between the two parties and he represents both to the other. All right. So that's the primary function of what a priest is. Now, in the New Testament, who is the high priest? Who is the ultimate priest? Jesus. He is a priest in the way that none of us could ever do. And in the capacity that we serve as a priest is kind of like a little assistant priest. Think about like the Levites, how they helped Aaron under the old law. They were helpers. They weren't the one doing the primary function. All right. So if you take that picture and then think about us, Hebrews 13, 15 and 16 talks about us offering sacrifices, the fruit of our lips. And then also as we share and help other people, those are sacrifices with which God is well pleased. So in worship, helping those around us. Psalm 141 in Revelation 5, 8, and 8, 3, and 4, we see there the imagery of incense representing prayers. So there is a sense in which we're raising up prayers to God. This is a sweet aroma to God as well. Our prayers consisting of thanks, but also requests as well. All right. One other thing that you don't probably think about too much is that as priests, as Christians, we're supposed to be mediating on other people's behalf. So 1 John 5, verses 15 and 16 talk about if anyone sees someone sin, a brother sin, and it's a sin not leading to death, then you should pray for that. And he goes on, he's very explicit, and he says, if it is a sin leading to death, I do not say that you should pray for that. So it's an amount of judgment that has to be applied in recognizing the distinction between these two kinds of sin, these two kinds of people, and then offering prayers on their behalf. 1 Peter 2, 9, again, we're a royal priesthood, and the whole point of that passage is it gets to verse 12. Is it says, because when God visits people, the Gentiles, the people who are not Christians, that they will glorify God in that day. We are priests helping people, reaching out to people, so that when they have the opportunity to respond to the gospel or God comes in judgment, they're prepared. In other words, they can be saved. They can do what's right. So there's a sense on which we mediate on God's behalf in sharing the gospel with other people. All right. Matthew 5, 9. Remember, we're lights on the hill, salt of the earth, peacemakers. So ultimately, what is the peace that matters? It's not the peace between men. It's the peace between God and men. All right. So that's all the things that a priest does, we're supposed to do. All right. So in this capacity, we serve as priests. All right. All Christians should be serving as priests. So something to think about. How about kings and royalty? Well, remember, 1 Peter 2, 9 talks about a royal priesthood, all right? We are children of the king. So Think of us, if we're children of the king, then we're like princes and princesses in waiting, right? All right, so preparing for someday. Revelation 1, 6 and 5, 8 and 10 in the King James and the New King James, they all talk about reigning with Christ as kings and priests. Exodus 19, 6 has similar language. Newer translations say like a kingdom of priests instead of kings and priests. But in this last verse here, even though it says kingdom of priests, it does say reigning with Christ. So even the newer translations that don't use the word kings, it does use the idea of us reigning with Christ. So think about this idea that we are also kings as well. Coupled with that, maybe one thing that kind of helps a little bit, if you think about the giant empires like Persia, Rome, and all of those, you would have an emperor, but they would also have many kings underneath them. People who had rule, like think about King Herod, right? Herod answered to Caesar, but he was still nonetheless a king himself. He had a territory, if you will, a little bit of space that he was responsible for and that he was in charge of. That didn't mean he wasn't king just because there was somebody over him. So just because, don't get stuck on the idea, well, I'm not in control of everything. Well, no kings are. Every king is answerable to someone, even if it's ultimately answerable to God as well. So husbands, fathers, mothers, I mean, think about the idea of kings and queens ruling at home. And you yourselves as children, I mean, how did somebody become a king? They started out as a prince or a princess, and they were prepared for that. That's the whole point, is while they were growing up, they were being taught and trained so that someday they could take over that position of authority and influence and be wise in that rule, okay? So in a similar way, what's happening? You are being prepared for a position of rule someday, maybe in a house, it may be more, but think about that. All right, Psalm 82 is a unique passage where it says that God comes and he judges amongst the assembly. He judges amongst the gods. And then he says that you need to defend the water. He says to these gods, you need to defend the fatherless, defend the widows, rebuke the wicked, rebuke the oppressor. Who's he talking to? Is he talking to like some spiritual being that, you know, we've never heard of or never thought about? No, he's talking to human beings, to people who are actually judges and kings in positions of leadership. And he's calling them gods. Why? Because they are mighty. They have great power. They have great influence. They can steer the destinies of people, just like a god with a little g, all right? So in this sense, we can be gods as well. Not because we have a special power, special ability, special place than anybody else, although we are all created in God's image, but we can have very powerful influence and judgment and ability to make significant change in other people's lives. This is only used once, but Jesus quotes it in John 10, 35, and 36. So there's, I think, certainly value to thinking about it this way. Now, if I've swelled your mind too much, okay, don't read too much into what is being said here. We don't want to think too highly of ourselves beyond what is written. All right? It's important to understand that the power that you wield is not something like God where it's inherent in you. All right? You cannot speak things into existence. You do not have that kind of power. You have the power of words. You have the power of influence. All right? And ultimately, that power stems from God. As you use his words, as you influence in the way that he teaches and he guides you, then it becomes powerful. And if you don't, you can, of course, use it for destructive purposes as well, for hurting other people. So don't think too highly of this. So the whole point in this is, first of all, what we just said, but you have a lot more power and influence and control than you realize. And sometimes, especially when we're young, it's very easy to kind of minimize ourselves and minimize our place in the world. Well, certainly we are at a lower station than where we will be. But understand this is something that each of us is growing into. All right, so the reason why I bring this up is as we're going through these passages that talk about kings and judges, and it seems so far away and so irrelevant to us, we will never be in those kinds of positions. No, actually, you already are. And you're certainly in training for something that's even greater. So I want you to think about each one of these things as being directly applicable to you. That you, as you go through your life, you will have many opportunities to behave and act and have the responsibility of a small king, of a small judge, all right? And certainly as Christians, being as priests as well, standing in between men and God. All right, so one other thing to keep in mind, again, if I've kind of opened your mind and swelled it too highly. Don't expect too much too soon. A principle that is throughout the New Testament, but you can find it in Luke 16, 10 through 12, is whoever is faithful in little will be faithful in much. If you're not faithful in little, then no one's going to trust you with much. All right. So there is a sense in which we each prove ourselves. God is watching us, monitoring us. He does not give us tremendous opportunities to make tremendous differences until we first prove ourselves. So be content with being responsible for little and be faithful in that. And if you are, then maybe someday you'll be granted with much. But don't expect too much too soon. Learn to be content and be responsible for the things that God has put into your court, if you will. All right, so one other passage for you to think about. In 1 Corinthians 9, when Paul is arguing for preachers being supported, he quotes from the Old Testament, from Deuteronomy, and he says that the ox should not be muzzled that treads out the corn, or so the law says. All right, then he asks a question that's really interesting. Now think about the connection. Preachers being financially supported, and what is he using as the proof text? Ox. Treading out corn and not muzzling them, or treading out grain, I think is actually the word that's used there. But then he asks the question, was this written for the ox's benefit or our benefit? Our benefit, no doubt. All right, think about what is implied by that. When God wrote the old law and he gave these rules about animals, what was his expectation? His expectation is that all of the Jews, all of the Hebrews, Israelites, would read that, and they would understand a principle about how to treat things fairly. And if you're supposed to treat your animals fairly, then how much more, this is an argument from the lesser to the greater, how much more should we treat human beings fairly? So all of those laws about animals and all the, they're meant to teach something else. And you're expected to see that and to understand that. So that should open your mind. As you're going through the old law and you're reading about all these laws, you're like, oh, what's the point? You're supposed to be learning about how to treat people fairly. You're supposed to be learning about morality, all right, on all these things. Like just even when it's talking about how to take care of your oxen. In the same kind of way, when you read about kings and judges and how to rule and how to influence, you're expected to take that and apply that to your realm, your sphere, where you influence and where you have judgment, if you will. So just a few examples. You can think about husbands and wives, parents, of course. You can think about elders. You can think about anybody that's in a position of influence that people are coming to. But just think about when y'all are standing around and somebody says something that's kind of awkward, or they embarrass themselves, or they ask a difficult question, and there's that moment, everybody feels it. It's kind of cringy. What is somebody going to say next? You have an opportunity there to steer the whole conversation, to steer the way everybody reacts and the way they influence. And whoever's kind of put on the spot, you can make them feel much better and see themselves as God sees them, or you can humiliate them and make them feel a whole lot worse. You are acting as a mighty one, as a God, as a judge, as a king in that case, influencing and steering the court one way or the other. All right? So this has immediate impact, the things that we're learning, to today, not just your life in the next few years. So think about that. Keep that as the background as we go through these questions. All right. Any questions or comments on this before we get into the questions I assigned? All right. So I've got this as number two, and all your questions, just back it off. This is actually question number one in your books. So how can justice be perverted? What is the short-term reward for injustice, and what is the long-term consequence? So let's talk about the first one. How can justice be perverted?
One of the things that were listed in many of the verses was bribery or bringing gifts before someone.
All right. So how does that work? How does a bribe work?
You offer them some sort of benefit in order to get your way.
All right. And then there's two ways to do this. There is the very obvious way, like, hey, I need this contract, or my cousin is in trouble. Here's $500,000 to look the other way, or to steer this contract to my way so that I get that business. That's a very obvious and very direct way. Most people are not going to be that subtle. And here's the thing that I want you to keep in mind. A lot of times when it refers to bribes, it actually just refers to the idea of gift. Every time you give somebody something, if you're not very, very careful, it can actually have the impact of a bribe, whether you mean to or not. All right. It's not always, hey, here's a gift, give me this favor in response. A lot of times it's just being nice to people. All right. So be aware of that and be very careful about how you use that. You can actually be, like I said, kind of inadvertently actually applying a bribe and not even realize it. So A lot of times we do favors for favors, and we're not even conscious of it. 17:8, a present is a precious stone in the eyes of its possessor. Wherever he turns, he prospers. All right, so or it prospers, as some translations say. So the idea is it helps them kind of over and over again. A gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. A gift in secret pacifies anger, and a bribe behind the back, strong wrath. So we see lots of different applications. It can get you out of trouble. It can also give you an opportunity, an audience to talk to people that you might not otherwise get to talk to. It can be used both positively and negatively. But so these bribes, they influence anyone in a position of judgment or decision, and it can create an audience, or like I say, they can get you out of trouble and avoid terrible judgment. So now, one other thing I want you to keep in mind about bribes, this is kind of a shortfall of them. If you couldn't persuade the person, influence the person in the first place, and you needed to give them something to get something, what are you going to have to keep doing? You're going to have to keep getting the bribes, or keep giving the bribes, because that's the only thing that got you there in the first place, and so you're going to have to keep doing it. So this is the kind of an inherent downfall of this. Once you go down this path, you're committed to that, and you've essentially put yourself in a position of blackmail as well. It's pretty easy for them to reveal the fact about the bribes. I mean, it's mutual blackmail. But anyway, so there's great harm in that. And notice he says, he who is greedy for gain troubles his own house, but he who hates bribes will live. Right, what does he mean by greedy for gain? Again, remember we talked about the very beginning of class about Proverbs and how they have a structure, and the second half is going to often be a mirror, either saying the same thing or the exact opposite of what the first half says. So if someone who hates bribes will live, what do we know about the person who's greedy for gain? What is the warning there? They're looking to get rich quick. They're looking for bribes. They're looking for gifts. They're trying to use their positions of power so they can get rich quick by getting these bribes. What's the consequence? They'll trouble their own house. All right, so people accept or demand bribes to get rich, to get more power. Why is that so bad? Well, to show partiality is not good, because for a piece of bread, a man will transgress. All right, so bribes, sooner or later, it's not just doing somebody a favor, like, hey, can I get this business? Sooner or later, it gets people to actually just sin outright. They will transgress. And so what we end up doing is, if you think about everybody who is immature and not perfect, they have a selling point. They have something that the devil can offer to get them to do what he wants. All right, bribes, gifts kind of lower that selling point and make it easier to get them to transgress. So we end up kind of playing his part in helping people along that path of destruction. A wicked man accepts a bribe behind the back to pervert the ways of justice. And so remember, if we think about being a king or queen, the court in which we rule, then those gifts can pervert justice and cause us to hurt other people and to mistreat them. These things also belong to the wise. It is not good to show partiality in judgment. He who says to the wicked, you are righteous, him the people will curse. Nations will abhor him, but those who rebuke the wicked will have delight, and a good blessing will come upon them. So that's 24, 23 to 25. It is not good to show partiality to the wicked or to overthrow the righteous in judgment. The king establishes the land by justice, but he who receives bribes overthrows it. So why is it bad? Because when we overthrow justice, then we ultimately end up overthrowing ourselves. Whatever, again, sphere of influence that we have, whatever thing that we're responsible for, think about a home, think about a group of friends, think about whatever. Wherever we have influence, we ruin that. We become a bad influence, and we end up becoming very destructive towards them. So that's why bribes are bad. All right. 28:17, whoever rewards evil for good, evil will not depart from his house. Again, think about the bribes again, and somebody perverting justice. A man burdened with bloodshed will flee into a pit. Let no one help him. So when we pervert justice, when we are not fair to other people, when we are not showing mercy and compassion, whatever the case may be, what ends up happening? Well, it brings a sense of doom on us, and then how is everybody else going to respond? I mean, if you're in a group and you've got somebody who's mistreating other people, when bad things happen to them, what goes through your head? Finally, they're getting what they deserve.
Michael? Oh, I'm just saying, hands off.
Yeah, exactly. Just let it happen to him. Nobody's going to help you. So when we, that's what we bring on ourselves. The other thing that we do here in 13:23, much food is in the fallow ground of the poor, so the untilled ground of the poor. And for lack of justice, there is waste. The king who judges the poor with truth, his throne will be established forever. So again, Think about our group. When we stand for truth, for justice, no matter the cost, no matter what it brings upon us, this is the only way that we're going to ultimately be able to preserve ourselves and be able to preserve our family and preserve those who are disadvantaged in this case. All right. So next question. This is number two in your book. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. This is 21:1. So why is it important for everyone to remember that the king ultimately answers to God and can be manipulated by him?
God is ultimately in control.
All right, and then so ultimately what?
We need to obey.
We need to obey, and if we don't?
Judgment comes.
Yes, yes, exactly. All right, very good. So can you think of some Old Testament examples where this was the case? Thijs?
Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar.
All right, very good. Anybody have any other ones?
Saul.
Saul. All right, which case are you thinking of?
Basically all of his life.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking just as he should have struck down the other king and chose otherwise. And
yep.
He was manipulated by the people.
Yeah, yeah. And then ultimately his throne was overthrown because of that and his other sinful decisions. God chose David in his place and established him. Anybody else? All right, let's look at a few of these. So, just a few thoughts. First of all kings ultimately answer to God. He's not beyond their judgment. Again, think about the argument from the greater to the lesser. If even the most powerful people in the world answer to God, and if he can manipulate them, and if he can bring judgment on them, and if he can accomplish his will through them, through the most powerful people in the world, then what can he do to us? So much more. All right? So all subjects ultimately answer to God, and they have to obey God and not men. Remember, as the apostle said in Acts 5:29, what were you saying, Michael? All right. So, just some examples. I've mentioned a lot of these already. Nebuchadnezzar, I think he's one of the most pointed because God specifically makes the point to him that God rules in the kingdoms of men, and he sets up whoever he wishes. And then he humbles him by turning him basically into a beast to roam the fields. And even, he's told that in advance that that's what's going to happen to him, and he still does it anyway. All right. So, this shows you the power of character flaws, that even though you know what's coming, people still go and do them anyway. So until they finally learn and let those things go. Pharaoh, of course, with the 10 plagues. Ahab thought he was going to cheat death by dressing up as a regular soldier. And then we're told that an archer or bowman drew an arrow at random and fired it. And it caught Ahab right between the joint and the armor. I mean, the most unlikely of places. Caught him right in the seam and went through his heart and killed him ultimately. So they took him out of the battle. But it was random to the archer. He didn't have a clue what he was doing. But God had already told Ahab, you won't come back from this battle. There was nothing random about it at all. All right, Absalom's another good example. Both Ahithophel and his great power to advise him, but then ultimately David's friend who overthrew that wisdom. Very clear case of manipulation. But even David himself, in 2 Samuel 24, it says that God was angry with the Israelites. Apparently they had become very cocky or arrogant in some way, and even David had become this way. And so it says that God used David to go and number the people, and it became an exchange, or it became an occasion for God to actually punish the people and discipline them. So, again, even a good king can be manipulated and can be used by God to accomplish his will. So, ultimately, remember, like I said, every king, every lord answers to somebody, and there's a king of kings and lord of all lords. All right, why is it important? Again, the emphasis is on why, motivation. Why is it important that a king make wise judgments? We've touched on this a little bit. I'm hoping you'll give me some of the things that we haven't said.
His decisions in particular will be weighed by others and considered.
All right, weighed by others and considered. Good. Anything else?
That's how he establishes his reign, really.
Right. That's like, so for his own sake, whether or not he's established, that's what it means by establishing his throne. The idea is establishing his rule or his reign, keep not being overthrown. That's critical. Anything else? Maybe?
It's his duty to root out all of the evildoers. He can't do that unless he makes wise decisions.
All right. Very good. So he has a responsibility towards justice and to deal with the evildoers. Anything else? All of these are good. I'm not looking fishing for anything in particular. All right. A couple others that we'll see as we go through. All right. But all of these are good. So excellent speech is not becoming to a fool, much less lying lips to a prince. Divination is on the lips of the king. Divination is the words of God, all right? Speaking as God. Divination is on the lips of the king. His mouth must not transgress in judgment. It's not saying that kings are inspired. It's emphasizing the fact that he has such power and such influence This is exemplified in 29:2. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. So it's not just his rule, his reign, and himself and his family. It's the people that he's responsible for. Whoever we influence, we have tremendous impact on them for their good or for their bad, their harm. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan. Oh, they're under oppression. They're under the burden. So, especially in the sense of think of a great king, the judgments have such a great impact on the people. It is almost like God is speaking. Again, king's not inspired. That's not what he's saying. But he's saying he has that kind of impact on other people's lives. So in 2 Samuel 16:23, it talks about Ahithophel, who was David's ruler, or David's counselor, and he helped Absalom overthrow David. And it describes his wisdom as when he spoke, it was as if it was the oracles of God. Or he was that wise, he was that astute, and he could guide people that well. Now, again, Ahithophel and Absalom were ultimately overthrown. Again, because God was in charge. And despite him being that wise, he couldn't outsmart God and he couldn't thwart God. So, but it just goes to show the great impact that can be had. Mercy and truth preserve the king, and by loving kindness he upholds his throne. Take away the dross from silver, and it will go to the silversmith for jewelry. Take away the wicked from before the king, and his throne will be established in righteousness. All right, so this goes to what we were talking about, the establishment of the throne of the king. And so the king's position depends on that. If he's not good at that, it's going to be a brief rule. He will be deposed. He will be assassinated. There'll be a coup or a revolution. So it's important that we do that. And again, think about your circle of friends. Think about the realm in which you have influence. If you mistreat them, that circle of friends will dissolve, and they will find somebody else to hang out with and for somebody else to be a good influence on them. All right. So do not give your strength to women. Lemuel's mother says to him, nor your ways to which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. So emphasizing people who are in a position that need help, who cannot help themselves, the king has to make sure that he doesn't allow anything to affect his judgment, whether it's bribes, as we've talked about, or wine, or women, even in this case, that his mother brings up. So this raises the next question. If it's so important that we make wise, helpful decisions that are so far-reaching, how do we do this? How do we make these kinds of judgments? So how does a king make wise judgments? What is the process that he goes through? Aaron, what do you have?
For the sake of his people, because it will influence all of his subjects,
okay,
and even other nations.
We had a question on why, and now I want to emphasize how does he actually do this. So, a king who sits on the throne of judgment scatters all evil with his eyes. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter. All right. So, emphasis on looking into things, investigating. So, we don't want to rush to judgment. We need to look carefully into each matter. A wise king sifts out the wicked and brings the threshing wheel over them, over the wicked. All right. So how does a person do this? This is one of the most important proverbs in here, especially for even at this age. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him. The first one. Why is this the case? Because the first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. You ever had a friend or somebody say, so-and-so did to me? No, I can't believe they did that to you. Yeah, can you go with me? We need to go talk to them, or we need to go do this to them, or we need to do whatever. What happened? Judge, jury, and executioner. Did the other person ever have a chance? No. But you weren't wearing any robes. You weren't sitting on any throne, but you were a judge, and you were a ruler in that case. Husbands, wives, parents, elders, preachers, anybody who is in a position of influence, this advice is for them. Make sure that you search out the wicked. You run the threshing wheel over them. You examine, you cross-examine. You don't rush to judgment, but you inquire carefully. So this is something that is the responsibility of every person. And then make sure that you establish witness credibility. Is this a person who's actually a good witness? All right. I don't know if we'll have time to finish this one. So we will finish this section next time, no doubt. So the next section I want you to prepare is we're going to keep walking backwards. I want you to do the one that's on friends next. And that's where we will, so just keep walking backwards through the book. And that's where we'll get to. So, all right, how is the king's wrath like a roaring lion and his favor like a cloud of the latter rain?
He has the power to both punish and bless.
All right, so there's great power. It can be either blessing or it can be a terrifying retribution. Anything else? These pictures are very colorful for a reason, very detailed for a reason. They're telling you something.
This paper is refreshing.
Okay, good, good. Maybe.
I think not only does he have the power to bless and to curse, he also has the power to bless in the best way possible and to curse in the worst way possible.
All right, very good. So, y'all have given good answers. I don't have time to say any more. So, we'll pick up with this question next time. And then just one other thought. If I ever ask a question, because as I'm going through and working on the slides, sometimes I tweak the questions, I add a new question or I delete a question. If you ever see me put a question up here and it's not matching what's in the book, it's very easy for me to forget that I've done that. So feel free to say, that's not in our book or that's not what the book says or something like that. So y'all help me on that. All right. Thank you all very much. Appreciate your time and your preparation and your participation.